Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrne, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrne Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. When I'm working on a report or other writing project in my office and want to organize my thoughts, I often lean back in my chair and look anywhere but at my keyboard or monitor. Look is a misleading verb because, more often than not, I'm not consciously aware of what I'm seeing. Were you to ask, why are you staring at that armadillo print hanging on the wall in your stairwell? I'd say, huh? What armadillo print? What wall? But every so often during my thought organizing stares, something about what I'm staring at strikes me as so different that it snaps me out of my head and back into the here and now. When this occurs, my immediate response is, why this object? And why today? Specifically related to the subject of this podcast, why would a clock that's been hanging in my office for decades derail a brain trying to make sense of some intellectual puzzle related to an entirely different topic? And a puzzle that I must sort out and write up to meet a fast approaching deadline. It makes no sense. What makes this clock so special? It's neither rare nor valuable. At least I don't think it is. Most likely it's one of thousands, if not tens of thousands, sent out as part of a promotional campaign to veterinarians, breeders, groomers, and others working in dog-related fields. It's plastic and battery-powered. Images of purebred dogs mark the hours instead of numbers. I can't remember a time when anyone commented on it. Except for those rare occasions when my computer is off and I glance at it to find out what time it is, I only notice it when its hands stop moving long enough for this to register. Then I replace the batteries. Otherwise, it's just there. It took me a while. But once I started really looking at the clock that day, I realized what caught my attention. It wasn't that all the dogs faced left, or that, regardless of breed, all the images are the same size. Depending on how you look at it, the pug is as big as the Rottweiler, or the Rottweiler is as small as the pug. But while interesting, I devoted the bulk of my attention to another quality all of these dogs shared. Compared to many dogs of the same breed seen today, all of the clock dogs are slender. Some might counter that full coats could have masked some extra pounds on the full-coated breeds. But I don't think that was the case. Disagree if you wish, but there's a difference between fat and fur. You can certainly feel it. Determining this visually may take some practice, but it can be done, especially when the dogs are stretched out in a show pose. Once I mentally acknowledged those svelte canine images, I knew that the clock's arrival had predated the era of expanding canines. Prior to then, these images would represent normal specimens of their breed. But that was then, and this is now. Today, it's possible, and perhaps even likely, that the pictures on my clock will upset some people. To those folks, some, if not all, of these dogs will look way too thin, even emaciated. Some observers may experience an overwhelming urge to fatten up those poor skinny dogs. Others may take this one step further and perceive the dog's appearance as evidence of animal abuse, Those in that group might wonder why I would keep such an offensive clock hanging on my wall. After all, when's the last time you saw any posts on social media or segments on the Animal Planet devoted to the heroic rescue of overweight or obese dogs? Never? In my defense, I might explain that, in decorative terms, I think of the clock as a benign space-occupying lesion. Sometime in the past, preceding the expanding canine era, I needed something to fill a space on the wall behind my desk. The clock was the right size, and I put it there. Had I possessed a Monet or a Van Gogh of comparable size, trust me, I would gladly have hung it there instead. Lacking such an alternative, the dog clock has hung in that location in glorious anonymity for years, until my subconscious mind thrust it back into my conscious reality, to the point I'm imagining defending its presence to invisible critics. But now that it's on my mental radar, at least for a few weeks until I forget about it again, I realize that this plastic wonder also illustrates the tipping point phenomena as it relates to human perception of canine appearance. Between when I originally hung the clock on the wall and the present, the dog-owning public's perception of how a normal dog should look has changed noticeably. For a significant segment of the population, normal dogs are now packing extra pounds. How many extra? It depends on the person. Was this a gradual change in human perception related to owner lifestyle and societal shifts? It's possible. For example, in their first 40 years of life, my parents experienced two world wars and the Great Depression, during which food was scarce. Consequently, food carried a potent emotional charge for them and the millions like them. Food equaled love in the sense that if they offered food to others, there would be less for them to eat themselves. The same held true for the dogs in this era. Dogs ate what their owners couldn't or wouldn't, which wasn't much. Some dogs preyed on small game or scavenged to supplement their meager fare, but those are two energy-intense approaches to mealtime that supported optimum weight at best. But the meaning of food equals love has changed a great deal since then. Instead of sharing what little you have with someone who has less, it became associated with feasts, including sweets and other treats. Pillsbury's slogan, "Nothing says lovin' like something from the oven," infiltrated the brains of young boomers in the 50s and 60s with all the cunning and tenacity of a brain-altering parasite. Instead of sharing some of your limited rations with valued guests, you prepared more than you and they could possibly eat, and finished it with treats. More food equals more love, segued into more sweets and other treats equaled more love. In some segments of the population, the equation gained a third component, the cost of the food. The more it cost, the greater the love it communicated. Dog feeding paralleled this evolution. Commercial dog foods replaced scraps or whatever the dog could scrounge or catch. But in what seemed like no time, the battle for the heart and soul of the dog food buying public yielded a dizzying array of flavor and texture options. And similarly, diverse dog treats for special occasions. The more costly, the greater the love. Or so that line of thinking went. The interesting thing about all this is that during this same period, human perception of the dog's contribution to human welfare also changed. Increasingly, unconditional love showed up in the dog's job description. The problem was that unconditional love is one of those chameleon phrases. Its meaning changes depending on who you ask, and sometimes even when you ask the same person at different times. But relative to perceptions, it seems like our dogs got the short end of the food versus unconditional love stick. Feeding them what we consider our love's equivalent of food seems so much easier, especially when our dogs must perceive and know us well enough to know when a mere look, brush with a cold nose, or a contented sigh as they lie next to us will make everything all right in our worlds.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.